content of this program is intended for people who are blind and hearing impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 2023 Walter Magazine. We begin with I Love Purim, an annual celebration at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Highlights an extraordinary accomplishment for both the local and national Jewish community by Anne-Monique Klar. In the Book of Esther, a story is told of Persian King Ahasuerus and his Queen Esther. When the king's top advisor, Haman, comes up with a decree to kill all the Jews, Esther reveals that she herself is Jewish. She risks her own fate to convince her husband to reverse the decree, saving all the Jewish people. This story in the Hebrew Bible is the basis for Purim, the most festive of Jewish holidays, a day to celebrate standing up for one's culture. Usually a raucous party, it involves reading the Esther Scroll, known as the Megillah, giving money to the poor, wearing costumes, and feasting with wine and hamantaschen, a traditional pastry. And here in Raleigh, it's become the basis for an annual party in support of the Judaic Art Gallery at the North Carolina Museum of Art. In 1971, Abram Kanoff and his wife Frances moved to Raleigh from New York City, where he had a distinguished career as a pediatrician, medical researcher, and clinical professor. The couple was also passionate about Jewish ceremonial art and history. My parents saw a contemporary menorah at the 1928 World's Fair, and that stimulated a lifetime of interest in art and particularly in contemporary Jewish art, remembers their daughter, Liz Kanoff Levine. Abram authored books on the subject, collected extensively, donated generously, and served on the boards of the Jewish Theological Seminary and Jewish Museum. He was also president of the American Jewish Historical Society. After the two moved to Raleigh to be near their daughter, Abram connected with Musa M. Domit, the director of the NCMA. It was natural that my father would find his way to the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Mr. Domit was very receptive, says Levine. Together, Abram and Domit came up with the idea of creating an exhibition called Ceremonial Art in the Judaic Tradition. With Abram as guest curator, the exhibit featured nearly 200 pieces, some on loan from New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art, Brooklyn Museum, and Jewish Museum, as well as 26 pieces from the Kanoff family collection. The popularity of the exhibition, particularly impressive given the relatively small population of Jews in the area, galvanized the two to create a permanent collection of Judaic art. John W. Coffey was the curator of American and Modern Art at the NCMA at the time. He worked with Abram to raise funds and select and acquire Jewish ceremonial pieces of, quote, art museum quality, as Abram described in a 1974 article in the American Jewish Times Outlook. For Coffey, it was a steep learning curve. I'm not Jewish and was not trained in the decorative arts, so I brought in consultants, experts who knew the field, to develop a plan to build the collection, he says. In 1983, the Judaic Art Gallery opened as a permanent collection with 81 pieces, many of which were donated by the Kanoff family. Among them was Ludwig Volpert's sleek glass and silver Passover Seder set with plates, dishes, and wine cup, a Bauhaus-era design destroyed by Nazis and refabricated in the 1970s, and Ilya Shor's engraved silver Passover Seder plate done in cut and pierced silver inspired by Polish folk art traditions. In addition to their beauty and ceremonial importance, Many of these pieces had stories of their own, having been smuggled out of Nazi Germany during World War II, another effort of racism and genocide that recalls Esther's story. We were the first American art museum, not a Jewish museum, to have this type of gallery, says Coffey. In 2001, the affiliate group Friends of the Judaic Art Gallery, FJAG, was born. We wanted to build the collection to the level where we could argue for a place in the new building, Coffey says. Together with other supporters, the FJAG works with the North Carolina Museum of Art to raise funds. It's been such a group effort. We hired consultants and worked hard to get everybody on board to pledge money towards possible acquisitions at auction, Coffey says. We were often competing against other museums or private collectors in Paris and New York. By 2012, the idea for a party to generate funds and celebrate the collection was born, and Purim was a natural holiday to tie it to. The theme of the first I Love Purim party was Purim Madness, and guests were encouraged to dress in interpretations of kings and queens. Each year, there's a different theme. Past themes include walks and locks, love and knishes, Hula and Hora, March Madness, and 007, Diamonds Are Forever, all of which have a loose connection to the collection. Thanks largely to the efforts of the FJAG, the Judaic Art Gallery continued to grow. Today, the Judaic Art Gallery is not just the most visible expression of Jewish culture in the South, but regarded as one of the most important collections in the country, says Coffey. This year, the gallery turns 40 and remains a rarity. The North Carolina Museum of Art is one of just two art museums in the United States with a permanent gallery devoted to Jewish ceremonial art. Coffey, who recently retired, has been supporting the museum on its mission to hire a permanent curator. With any collection, unless you have a curator who looks after it, eventually it becomes irrelevant or static, he says. Now, it's one of the most interesting parts of the whole museum collection. It's this gallery of dazzling objects that's completely unexpected. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the Creators Department, The Trackers, the best-selling author of Cold Mountain, opens up about his latest novel by Wiley Cash. There's an old saying that serious writers never write the same book twice, and Charles Frazier never has, but he's almost always written about the same places, which is to say Appalachia and the southern United States. The surprise that's in store for readers is that The Trackers, which is set in Depression-era America, ranges far afield, from the swamps of Florida to the big skies of Wyoming, to the sooty factory towns and transient camps of the Great Northwest. But readers who loved Frazier's previous novels we'll find echoes of those works in his new one. Like Cold Mountain, The Trackers is the story of a man on a quest. WPA mural painter Val Welch is in pursuit of Eve Long, the wife of a wealthy rancher who has absconded with a priceless piece of artwork. And like Frazier's 13 Moons from 2006, the new novel is awash in era-appropriate research, from automobiles to art and architecture to the politics of the New Deal. Like Frazier's Nightwoods from 2011, The Trackers expertly employs noir tropes like tight, scene-driven dialogue and dark, ominous settings. Long, the dashing, magnetic heroine, is a traveling honky-tonk singer who finds herself married to a wealthy political hopeful before pulling the plug on it all and disappearing without a trace. Her husband, who's sponsoring Welch's mural project in a local post office, makes Welch a financial offer he can't refuse. Track Long and find out where she is, why she left, and most importantly, who she really is. According to Fraser, it was nearly 10 years ago when the idea for the novel that became The Trackers first came to mind. We were up in Boone, and I was just killing time, he says. I visited the post office, which has one of those Depression-era WPA murals. After that, I had more time to kill, so I went to the library at Appalachian State University and looked up information about WPA projects, specifically the Treasury Department art projects. One of the first images I saw was a photograph taken inside one of those small post offices, and there was a mural in progress on the wall with two young guys working on it. Standing on the floor, looking up at them, was an older guy and a woman. They were both well-dressed, and I thought, okay, there's a story here. As the story rattled around in his mind over the following months and years, Fraser dispatched with one of the two mural artists and focused on a single artist and how he might interact with the couple that was watching him work. The artist Welch, along with the rancher and his mysterious wife, were born. Three characters drove the narrative in Cold Mountain, so I ask Fraser if there's something that spoke to him about using a similar triangulation of characters in The Trackers. Well, that's one of the things that appealed to me while writing this book. I could keep a handle on the relatively limited number of characters, because I have a problem sometimes with expansion, he says. Having that very clear arrangement of characters helped me keep it under control and forced me to focus on trying to keep the book short. But in The Trackers, Eve is the reason the triangle exists. I never lost sight of her as the main character. There were points in writing The Trackers when Fraser began to fear that he was in over his head, especially when the pandemic struck and he could not make use of the location scouting that had benefited all his previous novels, bringing the realities of place and landscape to the page. But he had an ace or two up his sleeve when writing about the West and about Florida. Fraser and his wife spent the bulk of the 1980s living in Colorado with their young daughter. And after Cold Mountain was released, they resided full-time on a horse farm in Central Florida. Of course, the process of writing The Trackers was full of research, but when you read about far-flung western states, the boggy swamps of Florida, and people who understand horses intimately, you are connecting with worlds that Fraser knows well. During the long years of writing The Trackers, especially during the COVID-19 lockdown, travel was on Fraser's mind. He was itching to get out west and look around, but he found himself settling for photographs, music, and art that was resident of the West in the 1930s, especially Woody Guthrie and Diego Rivera. But writing a novel as complex and rich as The Trackers is hard, and it takes a long time, despite how many books you've published before or how many millions of copies they've sold. It doesn't get any easier, Fraser says. At least it hasn't gotten any easier for me. And I'm just an enormously disorganized writer. Every time I finish a novel, I'm a little bit surprised. This article was edited for Time. From the music department, Best of the Fests. Outdoor music experiences abound in North Carolina. Here are just a few to put on your list by David Manconi. Springtime in North Carolina means college basketball madness, azaleas blooming, and the earliest days of outdoor music. Our state has a staggering array of A-list music festivals spanning numerous genres from now until fall. Here are just six you should be making plans for. Between apocalyptic weather and the coronavirus pandemic, rapper J. Cole's Dreamville Festival has had a rocky existence in its short history. But in spite of multiple postponements, Dreamville has been a huge success, starting with 2019's sold-out debut at downtown Raleigh's Dorothea Dix Park that immediately established it as one of the nation's top hip-hop festivals. Dreamville's second edition in 2022 expanded from one day to two, with an on-stage lineup featuring the entire roster of Cole's Dreamville Records label, and it also sold out. Round three returns to Dix Park the first weekend of April as another multi-day affair. It should be another big success, with Cole himself in the headline slot. Dreamville runs April 1st and 2nd in Raleigh. The granddaddy of music festivals in the Triangle, Festival for the Eno, dates back to 1980 and happens on the grounds of Durham's West Point Park. Started as a fundraiser for the Eno River Association, the festival, which also offers a craft and food market, has hosted a who's who of Americana-adjacent and roots artists, including Emmylou Harris, Doc Watson, and Loudon Wainwright III. Recent years have featured rising regional acts, including Mipso, Rainbow Kitten Surprise, and Indigo D'Souza. Festival for the Eno runs Saturday, July 1 and Monday, July 4 in Durham. Reputedly the first event in America to be called a folk festival, Asheville's Mountain Dance and Folk Festival was founded in 1928 by the folk music legend Bascom Lamar Lunsford. It remains the longest continuously running folk festival in the country, and it's as much about the folk dance traditions of Western North Carolina as the music. Mountain Dance and Folk Festival run August 3rd through 5th in Asheville. Although he made his mark elsewhere as an artist, John Coltrane was born and raised in Hamlet, North Carolina. He was one of the towering figures of 20th century jazz, a key collaborator with Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, and his fellow North Carolina native Thelonious Monk. The John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival has been paying tribute to his legacy every Labor Day weekend since 2011 with solid lineups. 2022 featured trumpeter Chris Botti, singer Patti LaBelle, and saxophonist Kirk Whalum, among others. The John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival runs September 2nd and 3rd in High Point. In 2015, the National Council for the Traditional Arts brought the long-running National Folk Festival, which has been around since 1934, to Greensboro for a three-year run. It was such a success that after the National Festival's Greensboro run ended, the city opted to keep it going as the rebranded North Carolina Folk Festival. Last year's lineup was typically eclectic, featuring everything from George Clinton's P-Funk All-Stars to the Winston-Salem Symphony String Quartet. Expect more of the same in 2023. The North Carolina Folk Festival runs September 8th through 10th in Greensboro. The International Bluegrass Music Association moved its annual business convention and festival to Raleigh in 2013, where it's been a huge success. Between the convention, trade show, Bluegrass Ramble nightclub showcases, awards show, and street festival, total attendance can top 200,000 when the weather's good. Past headliners have included Steve Martin, Alison Krauss, Bella Fleck, and just about every notable picker and singer in the genre. Year in and year out, it's Downtown Raleigh's biggest music festival. World of Bluegrass runs September 26th through 30th in Raleigh. This article was edited for Time. And lastly, from the end note, Kiss Me, I'm Irish. A Raleigh comedian, originally from Belfast, describes her hilarious perspective on how Americans celebrate St. Patrick's Day by Helen Wilde. When I found out my family was moving from Belfast in Northern Ireland to the United States in 1992, I was terrified. In our family meeting to discuss the move, it sounded like a fun adventure. America! That's where they make Disney movies! We moved to the States in late October. Unbeknownst to me, my first day of school was the day of the class Halloween party. I was excited about wearing jeans to school for the first time. School uniforms in Ireland are very formal. Picture Hogwarts. But on my first day, I found myself face to face with a student dressed like the devil. Weird country. It's hard to be different as a child. Even though Americans now tell me every day that they wish I'd kept my Irish accent, that was not a popular opinion in middle school. My brothers and I would practice our American accents to pass as normal at school and would only dare sound Irish at home. I was blown away by how proudly Americans identified as being Irish. The same kids who made fun of my accent would tell me they were 100% Irish. Though it was a confusing time, I was flattered to know my wee home island across the sea was so beloved by my new country. My classmates would ask me questions about Ireland and tell me how much they loved Lucky Charms and St. Patrick's Day. I hadn't discovered Lucky Charms yet, and was surprised to hear how much American kids loved a religious holiday, but I appreciated their enthusiasm. I was particularly impressed with the reach of St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland. I was surprised that Americans with English, Welsh, or Scottish ancestry didn't have the same fervor for St. George, St. David, or St. Andrew, since those countries had patron saints as well. Come St. Patrick's Day, my American friends would be double-fisting shamrock shakes and wearing Kiss Me, I'm Irish pins. All the while, my brothers and I would be out in the yard checking for snakes. St. Patrick was known for ridding Ireland of its snakes and or inventing Guinness. I'll let you guess which. St. Patrick's Day was always just another day at the pub, except you'd go to church first. Around this time, my parents started to have an annual St. Patrick's Day party. They were worn down after years of being asked, "You're from Ireland. What are you doing for St. Patrick's Day?" Baffled, my parents would say, "Would you like to come over? It'll be good crack." Crack is the Irish word for fun. It's a sociable good time. Like, "I went to Helen's last night. Was it good crack?" "Aye, the crack was good." We'd make soda bread and stew and play folk songs and sing. Indeed, it was good crack. Even if it wasn't what their friends were expecting, there were no leprechauns, no portraits of St. Patrick, not even a filthy limerick. When I was in my 20s, I finally leaned into the American-Irish St. Patrick's Day experience. I went to a parade in Pittsburgh and bar-crawled my way through the town's south side, an area notoriously known for college bars. At one point, I called my sweet Irish mother to let her know I had been enjoying my first ever green beer. "Can you believe it, Mum? Green beer!" To which she responded, "Aye, pet, just try to find some green water." This article was edited for Time. And from the March calendar, Stretch and Flow in the Rose Jackson and Evelyn Thiem Garden at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design as part of its Mindfulness at the Museum Yoga in the Garden series, which will take place once a month through May. March's session will be led by sports and yoga enthusiast Jeff Manning with the Alexander Family YMCA. Before or after yoga, explore the rest of the grounds, heritage trees, and walkways, or visit the exhibitions inside the museum. Yoga in the Garden series for March is Thursday, March 23 at 10 a.m. The event is free, and the museum is located at 1903 Hillsborough Street. Visit greg.arts.ncsu.edu for more information. You can celebrate the release of musical duo Joe Troop and Larry Bellerin's debut album, Nuevo South Train, at Durham's The Fruit. Bellerin hails from Venezuela, where he's widely known for his folk talents. Troop is originally from Winston-Salem and is a Grammy-nominated bluegrass musician with his band Shea Apalachee, whose style is also influenced by travels to Argentina and Spain. Nuevo South Train could only come about when a virtuoso Latin American folk musician, like my soul brother Larry, decides to make North Carolina his home, says Troop. "What Larry is doing in my stomping grounds is what I did during my decade in South America." Musician and album producer Charlie Hunter, rock and country musician Deshaun Hickman, and jazz artist Brevin Hampton will also be performing. Arepas and coffee will be for sale on site, and the Fruits Bar will be open. The event is Friday, March 24th at 7 p.m. $25 is the suggested donation. The Fruit is located at 305 South Dillard Street in Durham, and you can go to larryandjoe.com for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode. Of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.